premiers the sake from Carlisle to Mailer. Mr. Lando is going to give us first a theoretical approach to the question of hypertext. So we plan to stay from now maybe to 5 o'clock or 5:30 with a break. And after the second part of this afternoon, we'll do with the people on the seminary in the other room. Will be more a lab and practice session. So this is everything, and I hope that you will enjoy it to have him as much as I have now the feeling.
Well, we're both neophytes. We both arrived at San Sebastian at the same time, I gather, and we're both pretty dizzy. I hope what I say won't get you more confused and more dizzy. What I'm trying to do here is set up an introduction to the notion of digital culture and digital text. Start with that, the difference between digital computer-based textuality, whether it's the text is composed of images or sounds or verbal text in the sense of alphanumeric text, that is alphabetic and numeric text. Then I'd like to go on to hypertext and explain some things about that. In this next session, when just the seminar meets, what I want to do is introduce you to a form of hypertext that has been very popular with poets and writers. And it's very easy to use. I would like to use and introduce you to a series of different hypertext systems so you will not think that hypertext is simply whatever environment you're using at the moment. No one has created real hypertext yet. We're just getting close to it. One of the sessions I want to spend on the really important question, is the World Wide Web hypertext? And if it isn't, what do we have to do to make it so? I want to spend another session or day on writing hypermedia. What possible rules for authors and readers, or even designers of computer systems, can we formulate here? Now, since this is a workshop setting, I'm going, as I said, in the second half of today to introduce you to one particular system and get you started. I would like to see you people produce projects yourself because you really have to think with your fingers here. Right? It can't all be watching a screen when someone else is working, or it's very hard to take in what's going on. But I have brought along hundreds of megabytes of projects and CD-ROMs, which we have loaded or will load onto the three Macintoshes in the other room. So whenever I'm not having a class with you, you will be able to look at some of the things I'm showing you. That should make it a bit easier. Let's start, and I would also like, starting tomorrow, to meet with people individually to find out about their background, their goals in coming here, and what we can do for each other. As you'll see, a good deal of the material I'm showing you has been created by students. And my general assignment tends to be very simple, but its basic rule is you have to, I tell my students in America, you have to entertain and educate me. So that's basically going to be what your project will be. You have to find something that I haven't seen before or haven't experienced it in the same way. And that may sound like a big order, but if you're like any other students I've had, it will work very easily. Thanks, Jose. Let us take through. I'm going to start with the matter of printed text. This is in a system, the one you'll be using, called StorySpace. I'm going to set it up first. Preferences. And I'll get this set in case we use later on. I won't have to do this. And I should make it bigger. Good way to begin is what is the difference between the new information technology and what we've been using all along? You can take this in two directions. it's not so different, and it's completely different. Let's start with a tame approach, the one that comforts us. It's really not so different. First of all, this is not the addition of technology to art and literature and human culture. Human culture has always been technological. The greatest and most dangerous technology we use is language, and the second is writing. Many people who are suspicious of computing, and one can certainly justifiably be suspicious of computing, but many of these act as if pencils and paper or typewriters or printed books were in some way natural. But in fact, they're artificial, and that's why they're so wonderful. Computing is just the latest form of writing. So let's take a look and see in what way technology is or is not part of the way we write and think and how different forms of it affect. It should be obvious that we are dealing with cyborg situations. The feminist theorist Donna Haraway says the best paradigm or the best image for women is the cyborg, because all women, and I would say, and she would too, all human beings are combinations of the biological and the culturally determined, the technology. And as Carlyle and many 19th century people realized, cultural determinations, social formations, are technologies. Carlyle, this 19th century author, pointed out that my talking to people sitting in a situation like this, or having a library that you can go and read in, having the day divided into a schedule, is a mechanical arrangement. This is a form of technology. Adding computers to educational institutions, to libraries, and to art schools and museums is not adding technology to these institutions. It is adding the latest technology. So it's not as radical a change as one might think, because these are all technologically determined institutions, or at least technologically informed institutions. What technology does for us, though, that is what information technology in the form of computing does for us, is to allow us to defamiliarize, decenter, demystify what has become so natural to us, we assume it is in fact natural. I'm punning on the two uses of the word natural, the first meaning familiar, the second meaning intrinsic, inevitable, part of our construction. One of the great values of computing technology when applied to culture and information is it gives us a vantage point to recognize how technologized we have been. People didn't paint certain kinds of sunsets until they could get aniline dyes. One of my friends in music pointed out in a talk for one of my classes, you did not get symphonic music, you did not get particular types of concerti until the invention of the pianoforte. It was considered an alien technology at the time. Every step of the way, the arts have been heavily implicated in technology. It's important for us to realize that, and if you will, these days, to glory in it. So we can use information technology to see the strangeness in what has been so familiar. That act is what Jacques Derrida calls decentering. And that's why this kind of technology is so important. It decenters us. It removes some of our assumptions. Well, let us look. What are the assumptions of the book? why do I say those are the two qualities? The one thing that print text, and this includes reproduced images, has is approximately the same text can be reproduced many, many times. Now, the implications of this, can you hear me if I stand up and talk this way? Because I hate sitting down. Can you hear me? Can you hear me in the back? Okay, we don't need a microphone. Can Jose hear me? Sort of. Okay, I'll talk loud, Jose. Tell me to sit down. Juan Maria, if we were in the Middle Ages, before printed books, you would be writing down every word I said. Why? Because I'm so smart? No. That's the only way you could get a book. Think of that. The role of the educational meeting was so you could get a book and then learn to debate about books. With the book, which is a reading machine, it's a delivery mechanism for writing and pictures. Everything changes. You do not have to belong to the priesthood to gain access to a particular speaker. It's very hard in manuscript culture to gain access to texts. Several things happen. Among them, the only way you can protect a text in manuscript days, in the medieval days, was to keep people from reading it. Bizarre, paradoxical. Why? Every time you read a manuscript, it wears away. After several hundred readings, the text begins to need to be replaced. If you recopy the manuscript, you get what is called scribal drift. If you've ever played this children's game, where you sit around in a circle and each person whispers in someone else's ear the same message, by the time you get to the end of the circle, it's totally different. That's scribal drift. That is the change that takes place in transmission. So if you want to protect information, you don't allow people to have it. With books, it's different. You print as many books and make as many people have access to it as possible. This is an example of how a slight change in technology changes the way we relate to our culture and our information and ourselves. We'll look at some other things later. The question is, what happens when one electronifies the book? My image is a book joined to a computer. The important thing is all previous forms of writing are a matter of physical marks on physical surfaces. If I want to share this with you and you're not in my space, I have to physically carry it to you or have someone else carry it to you. If this burns, it has to be recopied. If it decays, it has to be recopied. Clay tablets, writing on leaves with ink, like some of the Buddhist and Hindu scriptures. Medieval manuscripts, whether in the form of scrolls or in the form of the codex, that is between covers like a book or the printed book, they are all matters of physical marks on physical surfaces. What is so different and so scary about digital art and digital thought is that for the first time, it's no longer physical, but a matter of codes, a matter of, essentially, semiotic codes, one layered on top of another. One of the things that this produces is a text that cannot be read without a machine. Now, in a sense, this is not new. When we recognize that a printed book or pamphlet is a machine to reproduce an abstract text, you realize you need that there to read the text. But nonetheless, once you see the text, you see it. With a computer, what's happening is you see on the computer screen something which is supposed to be called in memory. We'll talk about the implications of that. It has many, many implications, and this is what makes this material so interesting for the artist and the critic. These are the various things about the electronic book. It is virtual. We'll get to what virtual is in a minute. I'll close this down and start up something else. But the text is changeable. If this were a written book, a printed book, I could not do that. I would put white out on it. I'd have to do it physically. It makes no difference here. It is adaptable. We'll see from examples that you can do things to a text that change the relation of the reader and the author. Now, I am again using language, linguistic text, but this works with images just as well. Our relation changes a good deal. And of course, as we see, it is capable of being infinitely duplicated. We've all done this if you've ever used a word processor. And I always ask my students, where is this coming from? I mean, if this were writing, I would have to write each thing out. It would cost ink. It would take effort. This takes extraordinary little effort. I mean, I could take the entire thing and duplicate it if I really wanted to. It's just there. I could get rid of that. This is a different attitude which changes our relation to the text, changes the power of the reader and the writer in relation to each other. It also changes the economic cost of texts. It costs a great deal of money to produce a text in print. It costs almost nothing electronically. Reproducing it is radically different in scale. It's so much cheaper. This is the point that many people think it has no cost whatsoever. Let's talk what we mean by it being, well, some other things. It's capable of being moved about rapidly. Because, same as you can add this or subtract this, you can send this over a network. You can send this to 1,000 people instantaneously. You can send entire books this way. But this means the book is potentially more democratic because more people can have access to it without it doing anything to the text. It doesn't make it harder or more expensive to gain access to. These are all possibilities. And there are bad things, too, because you lose a sense of uniqueness. What else? What about it can be joined together? Well, let me close this down for now and show you a couple of things. Let me take... I want to show you how virtual text can be processed and changed. Now, this, we looked at one hypertext system called StorySpace. This is one, another one, it's more of an electronic book system, and it is called Dynatext. This is the electronic version of my book, Hypertext, The Convergence of Contemporary Critical Theory and Technology. How does this differ from the print version? One, we'll take a look at it, it is joined to all sorts of other texts. It is more than twice as big. Other people's writing enters the text. These are some of the theoretical implications, the kinds of things that Barthes and Ove and Derrida and Foucault are talking about in relation to the nature of the text and the nature of the author or author function. But let's look at this now just as an example of virtual text. What do we mean by virtual text? since not everybody is a native English speaker, let me try to get a part of the text here that will help us. We'll do two things at once. We could search this in a way we cannot search a physical book. Let's call up, let's do it that way. And it tells us that there are 41 uses of the word virtual throughout the entire book, and one can go through the book and look for their locations. One could go here where there seem to be a lot of them. These are all. Now, I'm showing this because these texts, I've suggested that people who have time might wish to look at this text, which is available in Italian, Spanish, and English. The electronic version of it is on the machines. I've done it in three different versions, so you can see different ways of reading hypertext. But the point is, this will be easy to follow through, and we're talking about I'm looking for a good example here in what sense we use the word virtual. I'm a little out of it at the moment. And you'll have to forgive me for a moment. It's my own book, but I haven't looked at this part of it in a while. Okay. Go back to what we mean by. One point I want to make, sort of contra Baudrillard, and you can see it here. Can people read this in the back? Or is it too hard to see? It's hard. Yeah, I'll try to use the other version later. Baudrillard thinks that if you oppose the physical and the digital, you automatically get a binary opposition into yes and no, into tests. This, I think, is a very false extrapolation. He builds on the idea that you have yeses and nos, ones and zeros in computing to build a whole world view. As we'll see with hypertext, it's really the exact opposite. Things are much more anarchic, and it's much more deconstructed than an opposition into yes and no. Okay, what would virtuality be? I'm looking for use of this. One way that you can think of virtuality, if you look at a magnifying glass, or a telescope, or a microscope, you see a image in space before you that people who write about optics call a virtual image. That's how you phenomenologically experience that image. When you work with a computer, you deal with this kind of fictionalized text or image all the time. My first experience of this was with using very large, old-fashioned mainframe computers. When you got on the computer, you thought you were the only person on the computer, because everybody who logged on, typed in their name and a password, was given a virtual machine. If you knew enough, you could ask and say, how many people are using this machine? And it turns out there would be 300 other people spread many miles around using the machine. But you only could see your work. And what would happen is between the time that you typed G for your first letter of your name, E for the second, George, the computer would go away and take something from you and something from you and something from you and then come back to you the next one, because things work so quickly. Now the point is, we experience that as our own machine, but that's not very important. It actually is both our machine and not our machine. In virtual text, you are working with a text which exists only while you are using it. The text that's down in memory is related to it by a series of processes. But unlike this, you are not seeing the text itself In fact, it becomes hard to explain what the text itself is. From this point of view, all computer images and texts only exist while someone is performing them. This is not only true of computer games and poetry and hypertext narrative that branches, but everything, it only exists while you are looking through it. It is always being kept in embryo, and it only is realized, actually, when you take a look at it. That is very different from the way physical text exists. Let us look at some of the other implications. Let me look, show you some more of this. You'll get some ideas of how this looks differently. If we went to this part, let's go to Derrida, for example. And it tells you there are this many examples in the whole text. 74 in the whole book, 41 here. Wonderful. Okay, we could just look through this. You follow a link simply by clicking. There are a few footnotes left in the book. When we get to writing hypermedia, we'll discuss things like visual and other design. Put this in just so people could see what a note might look like. Most of the notes were removed because of the implications of that, of having footnotes in something like this. We could go down through and look for Derrida. Well, let's take Derrida and click this. Something happens to an electronic book that cannot happen to a physical book here. Suddenly, you are in a totally different book. You're in this. Because my publisher had the copyright not only on some works by Derrida in English, but also an encyclopedic guide to literary theory, they could put in materials. Let me get back here. Like this. Now, if you go down through this essay by some other person, not me, you will find emphasis on something that I almost never discuss in my old book, Deconstruction. Bring up, and this is by another person. What has happened? Among other things, I have lost a certain amount of control of the text by putting it in a virtual electronic space. These are some of the things we're going to talk about. Once you code this, once you put this into a semiotic virtual space, you lose some of that fictionalized ownership you may have had in the past. You gain more. Authorship becomes inevitably much more collaborative. We're going to talk about this when we get back to hypertext in a while. But one of the things that happens is the text, all electronic texts, whether they're words or images or sounds, become open. The borders become blurred and permeable. Because if I mention Marxism, and I don't agree with much of Marx, I don't like Marxist critical theory much, I don't find it very useful. Many of the people in this encyclopedia love it. So if you're a reader, you can read my views of Marxism, and you can read someone else's, and decide that someone else's ideas are more interesting or more relevant to you than mine. And then you just leave my text and read that. Now, this experience is not that strange. This is the experience of wandering around in a bookstore or a library. So the paradigm or the model of the electronic text is the electronic museum or library, not the electronic book or painting. It has become multiplicitous. It has become many automatically.
Yeah, but it's a different case where it's set up by your publisher versus here in the bookstore. You have many other publishers.
Right. That, in fact, we do have things by many other publishers. We went and we asked other people, and everyone said, sure. There are a lot of other things. But you're right. When it is self-contained, and this is one of the problems of the fact that this comes on two discs as opposed to being on the internet. When on the internet, it is inevitably open, though the systems are not as sophisticated to take advantage of it.
So just to kind of continue in that direction, I'm curious, I mean, it seems as if what you're saying is that processes like the process that I use in the library
process by which I read in the library to look at a footnote to get another book out that's referred to in the footnote, to read part of that, to go from a footnote there, which might take time, but I haven't seen... Are you simply saying that these processes which previously existed are now under one interface, or do you believe that this is an inherently different process than the previous process of footnotes?
It's a matter of quantity producing a change in quality.
Okay.
That is, if you can do this so quickly, I'll give a good example of this. Two examples of this. People have done studies of reading with a foreign language dictionary. And it takes, I forget how many minutes, an average of something like 90 seconds to look up a word in a foreign dictionary. If you can use some of these electronic programs, you can do it in a second and a half instead of 90 seconds. Now think of that. You're reading along, you don't know the first word in Spanish, so you look it up. After 10 lookups, it has taken you 15 minutes away from reading to do that. We all know what we do. We put off looking using the dictionary or the encyclopedia as absolutely long as possible, and we read in this condition of partial ignorance because it's too costly to look things up. It's not even a matter of laziness, it's a matter of the amount of time we have and efficiency. When you can online look these things up instantaneously, they find that people use them all the time to check ideas, to expand, but the text itself has changed. We're going to look at examples of this. The text, instead of being separate, has become joined to a dictionary. So you may be reading Cervantes purely for literary purposes, but once it gets connected electronically, in a sense it becomes changed because it now becomes a device for language acquisition. I mean, there are people who have used this. I read all of Proust as a way of improving my French. It was, rather than reading grammar books, after I had some basic French, I just sat down and went through all 14 volumes. So, but that is much less usual in the print economy than in the other. Okay. I think this is a good time for this for the CD. I want us to listen, and I want you to notice this is Orb's Little Fluffy Clouds. Who's heard Little Fluffy Clouds before? Okay, so a couple of people know it. This is my technical expert here. Wait a minute, Jose. Let me give an introduction first. This is an example of sampled music in which someone has taken spoken language and repeated it. And I want you to observe what happens to this after a while. This takes about 4.5 minutes. My point is, after a while, certain segments that were originally, quote, just language, become used almost musically. They become detached from their context. And I want us to think about what the implications of sampling images and words are. Maestro.
Over the past few years, to the traditional sounds of an English
this
song...
This is not the best version. There are about 10 versions that I didn't bring my best
has been added a new noise.
What were the skies like when you were young?
They went on forever. We lived in Arizona, and the skies always had little fluffy clouds, and they were long and clear, and there were lots of stars at night. And when it would rain, they were beautiful, the most beautiful skies, as a matter of fact. The sunsets were purple and red and yellow and on fire, and the clouds would catch the colors everywhere. That's neat, because I used to look at them all the time. You don't see that. puffy clouds in the moon. They were long and clear, and there were lots of stars at night. And when it would rain, it would all turn. They were beautiful, the most beautiful skies, as a matter of fact. The sunsets were purple and red and yellow and on fire, and the clouds would catch the colors everywhere. That's it, me, because I used to look at them all the time. You don't see that. You might still see them in the desert.
I have for you is, what does this do to the idea of origin or originals or sources? I mean, what is the medium in what we heard, and what was the source? Can we distinguish this anymore? We've been brought up in a culture where one has very clear distinction, but digital technology starts to blur these. It doesn't make sense anymore. From one point of view, one of the sources of the music was this, the interview with this girl, which is used over and over again in Borg's music. There are at least, I think, seven different versions. There's one whole CD just with five versions, and it keeps changing. But it becomes clear after a while that the recorded or borrowed or sampled sound is a medium with which to create something. But more to the point, this act of music, this event, this musical text exists only on the CD. Think of that. It only exists, you know, there. It doesn't, you can't go back and say there's like a score for it or something. That's in some sense the essence of it. We have begun increasingly in the digital age, so this began in the analog age. What do I mean by analog and digital? Digital information technology requires a conversion into these kinds of semiotic codes. Old-fashioned photograph recording, photography are analog technologies. Videotape, those are still analog technologies. People had started to do things like this. The first sampling was done using tape, not using... So it's a very similar question to what several people said. What's the difference between reading in the old mode and this just because it's easier? There always seems to be some sort of a connection between the different information technologies at that divide. But what happens is something which is an act of virtuosity, a bizarre act in one information technology, becomes inevitable and common with the other. So one of the things that we should do is try to figure out what are, if not the messages in the medium, what are the tendencies that could be activated in computer-based media. One of the things that becomes clear, we're going to see this come up over and over again, appropriation, juxtaposition, violation of borders seems inevitable in computer-based media in ways that do not seem inevitable. Now, there are, in the history of entertainment and art, examples of kinds of copying and appropriation. We all know it. and in bizarre ways. Do you remember Milli Vanilli? Who's heard of them? A few people. They were a pop group, two attractive black guys who danced well, and they were style. They were the modern group, and that is that they were meant for television, and then someone else did the singing. And when this was found out, these people lost their Emmys and were disgraced. But it turns out that this has been very common. This is common even in film. Apparently, after Sir Laurence Olivier died, the film team had to find someone to read some of his lines on his last film, because something had happened and someone had dropped the mic or something like this. So they went to Olivier's widow and said, you know, we need someone who sounds like Larry. And she said, oh, there's this guy who a friend of ours, always used to sneak up behind my husband in the Royal Shakespeare Company and say his lines. And my mind is blank who it is, but he's the man who played Hannibal Lecter.
Anthony Hopkins,
who played the Inishiguro's Remains of the Day, who played the father, Anthony Hopkins. Now, people have seen this film. They're apparently very widely. This has been used in pop music. For many years, we have been dealing with essentially simulated information. That is, many classical music concerts, jazz concerts, certainly pop and rock, are not, quote, authentic. They have been fixed. If someone is off key, they take that separate stream in the text and they adjust it. The point is, we live in worlds in which the text exists only in the text. It's no longer justifiably or usefully described as being a mirror, a transcription of reality, as being about reality. More and more, works of art, texts, exist in their information medium per se, which is not to say they are not also making statements, but the basic fundamental relation of original and derivation doesn't seem to work anymore. It's much more complicated than that. We've talked a little bit about the virtual text and the electronic text. I want to look a little bit at in what sense we have electronic books. This will also has implications for the visual as well. I'm talking about markup, because this is the way Dynatext and to a certain extent the World Wide Web creates the text that we see. This whole matter of markup. Now, this is a passage we'll see. This is the way it would have been read until after the year 1000. What are the results of this, and why? Does anybody know why people wrote that way? Why do you think people would have written that way? Why would anybody do such a bizarre thing? Fit more words on a page. Why should you fit more words? Why do you have to fit more words on a page? What condition would make you do that? The cost of writing materials. In other words, when paper or other materials are so expensive, you have to find some way to save it. What effect does this have? Well, for us, it makes writing impossible. Try again. Better. Okay. What this also did, thank you for waking up my audience. What this also did was turn reading into a specialized skill that very few people could do. Apparently, more people knew how to write than knew how to read. People knew how to write their name in a few words, but did not know how to read. It was too difficult. Most reading was done aloud. We know that Virgil and Chaucer and others, when they read, someone would read aloud. If you've ever been to a Jewish service and you've seen them take a scroll, and essentially the purpose of the writing is to remind the person who's chanting. That's the way all reading and writing was, this transitional stage between the written and the oral, until it got rid of interword spaces, or lack of interword spaces. Okay. What happened? Sometime around the year 1000, writing became cheaper. People began to put